Well, welcome. It's my pleasure to introduce Rita Ballas-Gordon, today's speaker. So Rita's background is in an area of neuroscience that seems to me very exciting, synapse formation. And her training was with Wes Thompson, who himself was educated by distinguished scientists, among them Jan Janssen, Jack McMahon, both very well-known anatomists. And Rita then went on to work with Jeff Lichtman, whose pedigree stretches through Dale Purvis to Steve Kuffler and Bernard Katz. So here we have a talk this morning, this in the middle of the day, on mechanisms of synapse formation and maintenance, and in a long tradition and important tradition in neuroscience. Thanks very much for coming.
Thank you, Ron, for that lovely introduction. It's a pleasure to be here and to see some old friends and to learn about the interesting work going on really across neuroscience on the NIH campus. I decided today for this talk to give you two vignettes of unpublished work from my lab, actually both very new stories. The first one I'm going to tell you about is on the role of astrocytes in shaping inhibitory circuitry in the developing nervous system. And the second piece of work that I'm going to tell you about is really brand new and focuses on a new set of autoimmune disorders of the nervous system that has given us some insights into the role of synapse formation and synaptic maintenance in cognitive function. So let me start by reminding you of something that you probably all know already, and that is from the work of people like Frank Frieger, Ben Barris, and others. We've come to appreciate that what had been the unwanted stepchild cell type in the nervous system for many years, the astrocyte, has come to play a number of very interesting, very dynamic roles during synapse formation, development, synaptic function, circuit function, and so forth. And Barris in particular and his colleagues showed that astrocytes will secrete soluble factors that will increase not only the structural formation of excitatory synaptic circuitry, so think glutamatergic synapses, but astrocyte secreted factors as well as contact can also modulate the function of those synapses. We asked an analogous question a number of years ago now, whether or not astrocytes had the same effect on inhibitory circuitry. And the reason we asked these questions was because an MD PhD student in my lab by the name of Serena Berger Almeria was working on the role of neurotrophin signaling and GABAergic synapse formation and made a very interesting anecdotal observation that while growing mixed cultures of hippocampal neurons with astrocytes, as Barris had shown, increased excitatory synapse formation about twofold. She came into my office and showed me the data that said that astrocytes increased the formation of GABAergic synaptic circuitry somewhere in the order of 7 to 10-fold. And a second graduate student in the lab, Ethan Hughes, picked up on that anecdotal observation, and it's his work that I'm going to tell you about in the first part of this talk today. So the question is a very simple one, and that is, what influence do astrocytes have on inhibitory neurons, and do astrocytes' secreted factors influence the formation of GABAergic synapses and their function? Okay, so these experiments, again, doing the simplest thing first, which is a strategy that I learned from both my graduate and postdoc mentors, was to take cultures of mixed hippocampal neurons from embryonic rodents, as most people do, and either grow them by themselves, grow them in the standard sort of banker mixed culture style where neurons are seated on a confluent bed of astrocytes. So the astrocytes here not only condition the medium, but also provide whatever contact-mediated factors might be necessary for synapse formation activity, so forth. Or the final condition was neurons grown alone with the astrocytes grown on a membrane insert where the astrocytes continually conditioned the medium but were not in physical contact with the neurons. And then the assays, again, were very straightforward. In these conditions, we assayed excitatory synapse formation and inhibitory synapse formation here modeled in this cartoon by the blue cells using immunostaining and confocal microscopy, and assayed synapse function using vesicle recycling on optical methods or intracellular recording. Okay, so the first observation that Serena and then Ethan made was that neurons conditioned by the media of by media conditioned by astrocytes have dramatically increased axon length and branching. And you can see the images on the left and the quantification of these activities here on the right. When neurons are grown without astrocytes, the green neurons are those that are expressing GAD and that are inhibitory. And actually, at the stages that I'm going to show you, with the exception of all of the data at 4 days, these neurons are, in fact, inhibitory. The actions of GABA are hyperpolarizing. At 4 days, they're really undergoing a transition from GABA being depolarizing to being hyperpolarizing. When you grow them in the presence of astrocytes, you can see axon length and branching are dramatically increased. But more importantly, for what I'm going to tell you next, neurons that are grown with media conditioned by astrocytes have dramatically enhanced axon length and branching. And that's quantified here to the right from 4 to 10 days in vitro. You can see this dramatically multifold effect, whereas the effect on glutamatergic neurons is much more modest. Now, similarly, astrocyte-conditioned media has a dramatic effect not only on axon branching and length, but also on synapse density. And you can assay synapse density in a number of ways. The way that I'm showing you here is by immunostaining for the vesicular GABA transporter, VGAT, and postsynaptic clusters of GABA receptors, where the two things colocalize. At least there's at least 30% pixel overlap. That's our criteria, structural criteria for a synapse. And what you can see here in panel A is just a camera lucida drawing demonstrating the increase in axon length and branching when neurons are cultured in the presence of astrocyte conditioned media. And here on the right in this inset is a demonstration of the dramatic increase in the density of GABAergic synapses that you see when neurons are cultured in the presence of astrocyte conditioned media. And it doesn't really matter how you quantify this, but you can see that the effect is very robust. In terms of the number of synapses, there's a several-fold change and at least a 3- to 4-fold change in synapse density. So the increase in synapses isn't merely a reflection of the increased length and branching, but is a reflection of a synaptogenic process per se that's stimulated by factors that are secreted by astrocytes. Now, in addition to astrocyte-secreted factors increasing the number of structurally constructed synapses, they also have a dramatic effect on the function of those synapses. And one of the assays that we used to demonstrate that is shown in this slide, where Ethan Hughes used a antibody against an intraluminal domain of the VGAT transporter to mark those sites that were actively undergoing vesicle recycling. And you can see here in the absence of astrocytes, there are very few of those, but in the presence of astrocytes or astrocyte-conditioned media, the number of sites that are labeled by the antibody, that's in red here, live VGAT, live just meaning these assays are done in live neurons, and the points that are labeled here in white and that are pink in the bottom are sites that are actively going this recycling, are dramatically increased. And that's simply quantified here below. So the point of these assays is that they show that astrocytes secrete factors that increase the construction of inhibitory synapses as well as their function. Ethan went on to do a number of experiments to demonstrate, to ask really whether or not these effects were specific to astrocytes or whether other generic cell types also had this promoting effect on inhibitory synapses. He took conditioned media by fibroblasts, by Schwann cells, by oligodendrocytes, and so forth. I'm showing you one of these experiments in this slide where he demonstrated that media conditioned by fibroblasts didn't increase axon length, branching, or synapse formation compared to astrocytes here in the black bars. So this kind of experiment established that it was astrocytes per se secreting factors that increased inhibitory synaptogenesis and inhibitory synapse function. Okay, so the next approach that Ethan took was to ask, okay, what are potential candidate mechanisms for this astrocyte-soluble factor-mediated effect? And he went through a number of them. A lot of work is summarized on this slide, and it looks more complicated than it actually is. So I'll tell you what the take-home message is first, and then I'll step you through the data. This slide establishes that neurotrophins, neuronal activity, or cholesterol, three types of mechanisms that had been shown by other groups, including Barris, to enhance glutamatergic synapse formation in vitro and in vivo, modulated by astrocytes, were not responsible for the effect of astrocyte-soluble factors on inhibitory synaptogenesis. So, for example, scavenging neurotrophins or using TTX to block activity, or adding exogenous cholesterol or depleting cholesterol from ACM had no effect on the number of inhibitory synapses constructed or their function. So in one fell swoop, we were able to eliminate three very well-known mechanisms for this bioactivity. And that really left the question of, since we showed that astrocyte-soluble factors increase inhibitory axon length, branching, synapse density, and function, and that soluble factors from other cells don't affect inhibitory neurons, and that these effects of astrocytes aren't due to activity, neurotrophins, or cholesterol, that really leaves the question of, okay, what is it that astrocytes are secreting that are having this promoting effect on inhibitory circuitry? And I want to explain to you next the approaches that we've taken to address that issue. So as we were doing this work, a fourth mechanism was published by the Barris Group in 2005 or 2006 in a very seminal paper by Christofferson and his colleagues that demonstrated that thrombospondins, five different types of thrombospondins, are secreted by astrocytes in vivo, and they provided very compelling genetic evidence that thrombospondins were responsible for the astrocyte-promoting effect on glutamatergic circuitry, both with respect to glutamatergic synapse density and synapse function. So the next experiment that Ethan did was to ask whether or not adding exogenous thrombospondins to neurons cultured in the absence of astrocytes could mimic the increase in axon length and branching that astrocyte conditioned media had on inhibitory neurons. And the answer is that adding a cocktail of thrombospondins, we did a dose response curve with each and combinatorially, could not recapitulate the effect of astrocyte-conditioned media on these properties of inhibitory neurons. So he went on then to do the complementary experiment, which is to immunodeplete. I'm showing you here thrombospondins 1 and 2. We've actually immunodepleted four of the five. And you can see here in this Western blots plotted for TSP1 and TSP2 that the immunodepletion very successfully depleted thrombospondins from the ACM. And this immunodepletion is quantified here on the right. And the next slide shows you the results of immunodepleted ACM, the effect that it has on inhibitory axon, in this case, synapse density, but it would be the same for axon length and branching. And the bottom line is that immunodepleted ACM did not diminish axon length branching, or in this case, synapse formation. And importantly, the positive control for these experiments is that immunodepleted ACM, shown here in the gray bar, decreased the number of glutamatergic synapses, as you would expect from Barris's work. So this was an important control that was assayed at the same time we were assaying inhibitory synapse formation. So these experiments established that neither thrombospondins or cholesterol, neurotrophins, or activity could account for the bioactivity of astrocytes, secreted factors on inhibitory axon length branching and synapse density and function. So the question is then, okay, what are the possible mechanisms? And the brute force approach that Ethan took next was to ask, okay, astrocytes secrete a lot of things. I mentioned one of them that was not a protein, for example, cholesterol. There are metabolites. There are small molecules like amino acids as well as proteins. So the next question he asked was whether or not the secreted factors that astrocytes provide to inhibitory neurons that stimulate these activities are in fact proteins or something else. And he did this experiment in a couple of ways. I'm showing you one of them here. He heat and activated ACM and showed that that heat and activation destroyed the bioactivity of ACM on inhibitory neurons. In this experiment, he used trypsin to proteolyze the proteins that are secreted by astrocytes and showed that trypsinized ACM abolished the activity. If you add ACM and a trypsin inhibitor, you can outcompete the effect of trypsin, and the same with trypsinized ACM. So this experiment established that the factors that are secreted by astrocytes that are promoting these activities in inhibitory neurons are in fact proteins. And that leads to the question, okay, how does one identify the repertoire of proteins that astrocytes secrete that could mediate these potential bioactivities? And we decided to take a proteomics-based approach for a couple of reasons. The first one was that we had a couple of hints already from pilot experiments of the size range of the bioactivity that we were about to start to chase. And the second reason was that we are fortunate to have, as a very close collaborator, a wonderful proteomics expert by the name of Harry Ischiropoulos, with whom we had collaborated to publish a very detailed analysis of the astrocyte secretome, demonstrating 180 novel proteins that were secreted by astrocytes and doing some quantitative biochemistry on their relative proportions. So Harry was very eager to work with us to first size fractionate ACM. We could then assay the bioactivity of these different size fractions. We could either then choose to further fractionate or do mass spec and identify and test candidates. So this is basically the logical flow of the experiments that we are in the process of pursuing, and I'm going to show you kind of where we are at the moment. So the next set of experiments, we took astrocyte conditioned media, we size fractionated it using gel filtration, and then we used these robust bioassays that I've mentioned, taking advantage of the fact that the effect of astrocyte conditioned media on axon length, branching, and synapse density is many-fold. And in fact, the effect on length and branching is so robust, you really don't need quantitation to do the bioassays. You can do it by eye or with an automated method, which really speeds up this process and adds to its robustness. So I'm going to show you here the first experiment that Ethan did. And that was to take neurons that were cultured alone, and you can see here as the baseline in axon length, branching, and synapse density. And what you can see here is the stimulating effect of astrocyte conditioned media on these three bioactivities, significant compared to neurons cultured alone. And then here in the third set of bars is ACM that was size fractionated from 5 or 10 kilodaltons all the way up to whatever the native complexes were above 850 kilodaltons. And he took an equal aliquot of every fraction, reconstituted ACM, and showed first that he could reconstitute the bioactivity. So this said that our size fractionation wasn't destroying the bioactivity that we were pursuing. And then here is an example of, again, each triplet of bars, length, branching, and synapse density. For each bioactive set of fractions. And what you can see here is that the bioactivities map to the highest molecular mass fractions, and there's a molecular fraction in the range of 10 to 25 kilodaltons that has a selective effect on axon length, axon branching, but not on axon length or synapse density. So then Ethan took these fractions. I'm going to take you through now just the data that supports each of these sets of quantification below. You can see here that ACM in the very highest molecular mass fractions dramatically increased axon length and branching, less so for the fractions here between 50 and 150 kilodaltons. And then here, this set of fractions had a dramatic effect on axon branching. Okay. So he ran silver-stained gels, and then silver-stained them of each of these fractions, and you can see that each fraction has a lot of complexity. With Harry, then, we cut out equal-sized bands from each of these fractions, and we subjected them to mass spec. I just want to point out here that each fraction, since these are native protein fractions, consists of a mixture of both high molecular mass and low molecular mass proteins. And you can see that there's not very much enrichment here, but it's a reasonable first step. And then you can see here the complexity of individual bioactive fractions that Ethan also assayed. Okay. So now with Harry, we subjected the bioactive fractions to mass spec, and we took the list of proteins that came out of that analysis and subjected them to a computational and functional ontology analysis that consisted of three steps. So running the proteins that were identified by mass spec through signal P to identify those that were classically secreted, through Cytoscape and Bingo for do a gene ontology analysis based on their relative functions, and then finally through secretome P to try to identify those proteins that were non-classically secreted that could be candidates. And you can see here the number of proteins that we identified in our bioactive fractions is in the range of 20 to 30, which is in the ballpark of the number of proteins that could be bioassayed in the ways that I've just described. Now, these proteins fall into a number of categories that, again, are not too surprising. A number involved in adhesion, neuroid outgrowth, axon guidance, and synaptogenesis. And the list of proteins, I don't remember if I put a slide in here or not, but we are in the process right now of testing those candidates. The 25 to 30 or so that look the most promising. There's a couple in particular that are very encouraging, including a secreted form of NCAM that has been previously shown by Patricia Manis's group to have a selective effect in vivo on inhibitory axon length, axon outgrowth, but not on branching or synaptogenesis, for example, and on a proteolytically cleaved form of agarin that seems to have a very robust effect on synapse formation in our bioassays. It's too early to identify these as bona fide candidates, but these are two examples of proteins that we're pursuing. And we're assaying them in the ways that you might imagine, just by adding recombinant protein to neuron-only cultures and repeating these robust bioassays, growing neurons on transfected, for example, 293 cells and bioassaying them. And then the next couple of steps will be to knock down gene expressions using siRNA and assay the media that is the minus ACM, if you will. And then finally, the goal of these experiments is to assay inhibitory synaptogenesis and inhibitory circuit construction in the relevant knockout mouse models. Okay, so what I've shown you so far, then, is that astrocytes secrete factors that selectively increase inhibitory axon length and branching and synapse formation and function. I've ruled out a number of mechanisms that account for these bioactivities and shown you that large molecular protein complexes mediate these effects. And what's interesting, just on first principles about this work, even in the absence of having identified the smoking gun candidate or candidates at this point, is that the cellular and molecular mechanisms by which astrocytes influence the construction of circuitry in the nervous system are quite different from the thrombosmondin-mediated mechanisms that modulate excitatory synaptogenesis that clearly don't affect inhibitory synaptogenesis. So astrocytes are doing two kinds of things. They're secreting factors that influence glutamatergic synapse formation and function, and another set of non-overlapping signals that's affecting GABAergic synapse formation and function. And these would have dramatic effects on circuit formation in the intact nervous system. Okay. What I want to do next for the remainder of the talk is switch to a second vignette of a brand new project in the lab. It's only really been going on for several months. It's a collaboration with a lab neighbor of mine, a clinical neurologist by the name of Josep Dalmau, who identified a new series of autoimmune disorders that are actually synaptic and that have dramatic effects on memory, cognition, and psychosis in human patients. And Josep and I have been working together to understand the molecular, cellular, and synaptic mechanisms of these disorders with the ultimate goal of understanding how neural circuits and these behaviors are affected in human populations. I'm very excited about this work, and it's one of the first times that I'm speaking about it, so I hope you'll follow me through this very interesting story. Okay, so Josep is a neuro-oncologist and had become an expert on what are called paraneoplastic encephalopathies. Paraneoplastic just means the remote effect of a primary tumor that's mediated by, often mediated, but not always by the immune system. And in the nervous system, there are two particularly well-known forms of paraneoplastic disorders that you might be familiar with. Based on my neuromuscular junction background, I immediately thought of myasthenia gravis, in which patients that have either thymomas or sometimes small cell cell carcinoma of the lung and other disorders as well can raise autoantibodies directed against subunits of the acetylcholine receptor. These antibodies bind to the acetylcholine receptor, leading to their internalization, decreasing NMJ function, causing weakness and ultimately paralysis and death. And a second well-known example that's presynaptic is Lambert-Eaton syndrome, in which patients typically with small cell lung carcinoma, but also other disorders again, raise antibodies against voltage-gated calcium channels, thereby interfering with the release of neurotransmitter presynaptically. A small subset of these disorders have dramatic effects in the central nervous system, and these are grouped under the rubric of immune-mediated limbic encephalitis. They often result in very profound and acute disturbances of memory, behavior, cognition, sometimes associated with seizures, not always. And the categories of disorders that had been identified up until this work that Josep and his colleagues published recently were showing that these effects were due to antibodies that were associated with intracellular proteins or cytotoxic T cells. But Josep showed in late 2007 that there were new categories of encephalopathies that were associated with antibodies to cell surface antigens. that these occurred with or without a peripheral cancer association, and that the autoantigens, in fact, are quite diverse, and some defined new clinical neurological syndromes. And I'm going to tell you about one of those in some detail, and then mention the three or four others that we've recently identified at the very end of the talk. Okay. So now the antigens against which patients raise autoantibodies can be quite diverse, and this is just a partial list. I've already mentioned a couple of them. For myasthenia gravis, the ACH receptor subunits, for Lambert-Eaton, voltage-gated calcium channels. And you can see here the other, both surface and intracellular antigens that are associated with these disorders, as well as the most commonly associated peripheral tumor. So these disorders are, in general, quite common, but typically, they tend to be peripheral. Josep came to realize after studying a number of patients that presented with a distinct set of symptoms that there were two categories. I'm showing you one of them here. The first category of patient raised autoantibodies against the NR1 subunit of the NMDA receptor. He published the first paper in 2007, and we published a cellular and clinical analysis just late last year. And the second disorder of this type that I'll allude to at the end are a set of patients that raised autoantibodies against the GluR1 or GluR2 units, subunits of the AMPA receptors. So for the first time here, you have a encephalopathy that's associated with, and we believe caused by, autoantibodies in the periphery that are raised against these antigens that are aberrantly presented often by a tumor. The most common tumor type here is an ovarian teratoma, which will differentiate and give rise to all kinds of tissue, including nervous tissue, express NMDA receptors, and the immune system mounts an immune response to these aberrantly expressed antigens. Those antibodies can be detected in the serum, and if that's all that happens, nothing bad happens in the CNS. But often what happens in patients is either a genetic predisposition to a leaky blood-brain barrier, presence of a flu or a cold, the antibodies or the cells producing antibodies will cross the blood-brain barrier, take up residence in the CNS. The CSF will have a very high titer of these antibodies, and then devastating clinical consequences can ensue. The way Josep identified this disorder is outlined here on this slide, which is taken from his 2007 paper, as well as work that he and Dave Lynch and I have done together. The first thing was to take both serum and CSF from affected patients and to stain sagittal sections of rodent brain. What I'm showing you here is a sagittal section of an adult rat brain, where you can see that these autoantibodies, human autoantibodies, are binding very highly to rodent hippocampus, a little bit to cerebellum and less to striatum, and not very much to cortex. What's interesting about this pattern is I told you already, kind of the punchline, which is that the autoantigen here is the NR1 subunit of the NMDA receptor. The NR1 subunit is expressed everywhere in the nervous system, not just in hippocampus, and that suggests that there might be a particular epitope, either a post-translational modification of that epitope or the way that epitope is presented, that happens to be unique to hippocampus that these antibodies recognize, and many of the clinical consequences, the clinical manifestations of this syndrome, are due to hippocampal dysfunction, which is why the hippocampus became a focus of our collaborative work. What I'm showing you here in B is an example of a hippocampal neuron from an embryonic rodent placed into tissue culture, as in the experiments that I told you about in the first half of my talk, that was stained live, so not fixed, not permeabilized, with human anti-NR1 antibodies. And you can see here the pattern of decoration of clusters on the surface of these cells that Ethan Hughes and Zhao-Yu Peng in my lab showed that are, in fact, synaptic, and in fact are also co-labeled with commercial antibodies against NR1. But one definitive assay is shown in C, D, and E, and that was simply to transfect heterologous cells with NR1 and NR2B and stain them with patient antibodies. Transfected cells are shown here in green. Patient stained cells are shown here in red, and you can see the co-localization here, establishing that NR1 was, in fact, the subunit of interest here. Now, Josep also did immunoprecipitations and mass spec, confirming that NR1 was the band that was recognized by patient autoantibodies. Okay. So what is the syndrome? What is interesting about the syndrome? our characterization of the first 100 patients from screening from around the world show that most of them had a median age of 23 years or so, but the age range is from 5 to 76, and in fact, Josep has just had a paper accepted in Annals of Neurology that documents this particular syndrome in pediatric cases that has a very interesting clinical presentation that I won't talk about, but I'd be happy to talk about in the question and answer period. Typically, young women will present to their physician or sometime to the emergency room with an acute change in behavior or personality, so a kind of a classic psychosis. They're typically admitted to the psychiatric ward, but many of these patients, not all, but many, will rapidly progress, develop short-term memory loss, sometimes seizures, and in particular, decreased levels of consciousness and catatonia, which then, of course, calls into question the initial psychiatric diagnosis. Neurology is called in. A couple of things are done at that point. An MRI, which establishes inflammation, and in particular in the limbic system, so again, consistent with limbic encephalitis. Second, CSF, spinal tap to assay CSF, which is then assayed for ELISA, using ELISA, demonstrating the presence of anti-NR1 antibodies. Many of these patients, when the syndrome was initially identified, if they weren't treated very rapidly with plasmapheresis or immunosuppression, would hypoventilate, develop abnormal motor behaviors, autonomic instability, and EEG slow activity, and have to be supported on a ventilator. And the first cohort of patients that were identified by Josep and his clinical colleagues didn't survive. With the recognition of this disorder, now patients typically, if they're treated promptly, will not only survive, but will recover complete function. And this slide documents that patients do respond to early treatment. If a tumor is present and it's removed early, you can see here the majority of patients recover. If the syndrome is identified late, or there's no tumor identified, or there's no treatment, significantly reduced percentage respond or recover. And if no tumor is identified, the outcome is often somewhat problematic. And typically, if there's no tumor resection or there's no response to immune suppressive therapy, there can be relapses that can be quite devastating. This slide documents the antibody titers of patients, both in the CSF and in the serum. And what's interesting here is that the CSF titers in these patients are typically quite a bit higher than the titers in the serum. And that suggests that there's an intrathecal synthesis of antibody. It's not just one event of antibodies crossing the blood-brain barrier, but cells actually producing antibodies cross and take up residence. And there's production of antibodies in the CSF that access the cells and synapses in the CNS that have these devastating consequences on behavior. And you can see here the titers of people with tumor, without tumor, or controls. Those with tumor, even those subset of patients that don't have tumor, have dramatically elevated CSF titers. And you can see here that with the initial identification of either serum or CSF titer, followed by either immunotherapy or plasmapheresis, you can see here typically, but not always, as shown here by the red lines, the titers will drop and the patients will improve. Okay, so my lab happened to move next door to Josep's just as the syndrome was being identified. And he knew that we were synaptic biologists interested in synapse formation and synapse function and mechanisms of those two phenomena. So he asked us if we'd be interested in studying first in vitro and then in vivo the effects of these patient autoantibodies on synapses. The first experiment that we did I've already showed you, which is to show that these autoantibodies labeled surface clusters on live neurons. Ethan Hughes and Xiaoyu Peng in my lab went on to show that those clusters were, in fact, surface NR1 clusters simply by colocalization between immunostaining for an NR1 subunit and what the patient CSF recognized. And you can see the nice colocalization in this panel here. And they did the same experiment in sections from rodent brain. And if you look at this last panel, you can see the colocalization between clusters labeled by patient CSF, NR1, and then another postsynaptic marker, PSD95, that's a marker of glutamatergic synapses. So this established both in vitro and in vivo that patient antibodies from the CSF recognized NMDA receptor clusters in these cells on the surface of cells and in tissue as well. Okay. Now, the next experiment that Ethan and Xiaoyu did was to demonstrate what effect patient antibodies had on cells and synapses. And I can cut to the chase and tell you that a number of control experiments showed that patient antibodies didn't induce cell death, decrease dendritic branching or dendritic outgrowth, neurite outgrowth, and had no effect on dendritic spine density or motility. So the effects that I'm going to tell you next on synapses are specific to synapses in a couple of very interesting ways. The first one is shown in this slide, which is that if you treat cells with CSF from control patients that don't have this disorder, you can see here a normal density of surface NR1, here is the total NR1 staining in permeabilized cells, and then the colocalization between the glutamatergic synapse marker PSD95, surface NR1, and total NR1. But after treating cells for as little as a day here with patient CSF, you can see the dramatic decrease in surface NR1 and total NR1, and the colocalization here below. That's quantified here. You can see this dramatic decrease. And not only can you assay this by counting the number of surface clusters, you can also do this with surface biotinylation, where you can demonstrate that treating cells with patient, now this is IgG purified from serum, dramatically decreases NR1 without affecting, for example, GABA receptor clusters, so GABA receptor protein on the surface. Okay. Now, interestingly, this effect, it's almost a molecular excision of NR1-containing NMDA receptors, because Ethan and Xiaoyu did a series of experiments, some of which are shown here, to establish that the clusters of other synaptic proteins are not affected. So, for example, PSD95 itself, a marker of glutamatergic synapses, is not affected. When you incubate cells from anywhere from a day to 7 days with patient antibodies, V-glut, a presynaptic marker, not affected, and AMPA receptors are not affected in patients that have autoantibodies against NR1. So these antibodies have a very specific effect on surface NR1-containing receptor clusters. Interestingly, they went on to show that as in patients that respond to immune suppression and plasmapheresis to reduce antibody titers both in the CSF and in the periphery, and recover from these devastating symptoms, cells too will recover from the patient antibody-induced decrease in surface NR1. So here are cells treated with control CSF, treating them with patient CSF, in this case for a week from 7 to 14 days in vitro, dramatically decreases the density of NR1 clusters. But if you remove the patient CSF and replace it with control CSF, it doesn't matter what time frame you do the experiment or how long you do it for, you can see that the surface NR1 clusters recover. And that's quantified here below. You can see the decrease in NR1 clusters per 20 microns of dendrite after 3 days or 7 days of treatment and after the recovery. And here, no change, for example, in the density of another postsynaptic protein, PSD95. So patient CSF decreases surface NR1 cluster density reversibly. And furthermore, not surprisingly, also decreases the synaptic localization of these NR1-containing receptors reversibly. So here you're looking at V-glut as a presynaptic marker, PSD95 as a postsynaptic marker, and patient labeled NR1. And you can see here again, patient treatment, a decrease in synapses and that recovers, and the quantification here below. Okay, so again, perhaps not surprisingly, but interestingly, the effects of patient antibodies on cells and synapses assayed in this way are titer dependent, as you might imagine. So I'm showing you panels similar to the ones that I've shown you already in the top. The bottom here is a series of analyses. We wanted to know if the antibodies from all of the patients had the same effect on cells and whether or not those effects were in fact titer dependent, as one might imagine. And so what we're plotting here is the, for example, NR1 cluster density versus antibody titer. In red are the 10 or 12 patients that Ethan and Xiaoyu assayed, and in black are control patient CSF. And you can see here a titer dependent decrease in all of the parameters that I've just described. NR1, the density of surface receptors, the density of synaptic receptors, but no change, for example, here we're mapping presynaptic terminal density using Bassoon as a marker for presynaptic terminals. And then in the panels below, we took CSF and patient antibodies from the same patients that were assayed, typically at the time of presentation and then sometime later after improvement of symptoms when titers dropped. And what you can see here, the points on the right are the higher titer first assay. The points on the left are the lower titer second assay, and then in black are the controls. You can see here, even with inpatient samples, titer-dependent effects on total NR1, surface NR1, synaptic NMDA receptors, and presynaptic terminals, no effect. So what this establishes is that for a cohort of 10 randomly selected patients representing the range of titers of anti-NR1 antibodies, all of the antibodies are having the same kinds of effects on cells and on synapses. Now, based on the work that was done by Pestrock and Drachman on the effects of autoantibodies against the ACH receptor, leading to the capping and cross-linking of those surface receptors and their internalization, decreasing surface receptor density at the NMJ and myasthenia gravis, we went on to ask whether or not these antibodies had an acute blocking effect on receptors or caused, for example, focal lysis of spines and synapses, which seemed unlikely based on the immunostaining data that I just presented, or whether or not patient antibodies bound to surface epitopes cross-linked receptors leading to their internalization. And that experiment is diagrammed here. So if it were a patient IgG-mediated capping, cross-linking, and internalization, you would expect to see a decrease in surface receptor density, and that's what I've shown you so far. We prepared FAB fragments from patient IgG. FAB fragments will bind to surface receptors, and we show that, in fact, that binding is similar to the intact IgG, but because there's no cross-linking, there's no internalization, and surface density would be unaffected. And then finally, we could take the FAB fragments, add an anti-FAB antibody, cap and cross-link them, and then we should get internalization, and we should again see a decrease in total surface receptor density. And that's what I'm showing you up above here. If you just look at the top row, this is control IgG, so you see whatever density of NR1 clusters there are on the surface, the decrease induced by patient IgG, no change induced by patient FAB fragments, and then a decrease induced when you cross-link those FABs with anti-FAB. So we established, and this is just quantified here in the lower left, so we established that the mechanism of loss of surface receptors is, in fact, similar to that in myasthenia, where there's antibody binding to a surface epitope, cross-linking and internalization, leading to a decrease in surface receptor localization that, as I've showed you, is specific for NR1 and not a wholesale, for example, lysis or destruction of the synapse. Okay. Now, I'm just going to show you here one piece of data that patient CSF containing anti-NR1 antibodies doesn't affect the density of spines or filipodia. And you can see that from these images here on the left and the quantification here on the right. So again, a very specific molecular excision of NR1 containing NMDA receptor clusters from synapses. And then here, Ryan Shao, a rotation student in my lab, did this analysis. He did it in a very nice way. He took images of cells filled with by transfection with tomato, and then he treated these cells for a day, 3 days, or 7 days. I'm showing you the one-day data here, and then re-imaged them and showed that treatment with patient CSF containing anti-NR1 antibodies had no effect on dendrite number, on dendrite length, or on dendritic branching is assayed by a Scholl analysis, which just gives you an analysis of a readout of dendritic complexity. So again, supporting our contention that these are really disorders, autoimmune disorders of the synapse, resulting in a deletion of NR1 from synaptic sites. Okay. Recently, we've gone on to corroborate this immunostaining and cell biological analysis with intracellular recording. And what you can see here, just to cut to the chase, is that when you treat cells with control CSF, these are whole cell recordings of synaptic currents in the absence of magnesium or in the absence of magnesium and the presence of APV, you can see an APV-sensitive NMDA receptor-mediated late component in the current. That's been well documented by many groups. But in cells that are treated with patient CSF, you keep the rapid inward current mediated by AMPA receptors. There's no change in amplitude, but you lose the late NMDA receptor mediated component. And that's quantified here below. Each point represents a cohort of patient treated cells or controls. And you can see that this set of data is very much under construction. The point is just that patient antibodies have a selective effect on NMDA receptor synaptic currents, but not on AMPA receptor currents, for example. Okay, so While a cellular analysis in vitro is all very well and good and provided us with a set of very robust tools to analyze the effect of patient antibodies on synapses, the goal of that work, just to kind of step back for a second and put it into context, is to work in cells, work in an in vivo model, and do some circuit analysis, some synapse function analysis, and some behavioral analyses with the goal of understanding how those patient antibody-induced defects cause the behavioral defects in animals, for example, and ultimately the behavioral and cognitive disorders disorder that is such a hallmark of these encephalopathies in humans. So as a step in that direction, I just want to end my talk today with a provocative slide that suggests that we are, in fact, pointed in the right direction, and that is to demonstrate that we can infuse patient antibodies into the hippocampus of rodents. These are actually the top experiments here were done in the rat. The bottom experiments here are done in the mouse. But you can see here the binding of patient IgG to hippocampus and surrounding cortex, whereas infusion of control IgG, obviously there's no binding. And here in below, in a series of mice that we did as pilot experiments, we infused mice with control IgG for 2 weeks or patient IgG for 2 weeks, and then we assayed either NR1 clusters, presynaptic terminals by using SV2 staining, or total cell morphology and density using DAPI. And I just want to direct your attention here to the final panel in red showing NR1 receptor density in a low mag view of the hippocampus here and a higher mag view of just a portion of the hippocampus showing NR1 containing puncta in the inset. And you can see in the hippocampi that are treated with patient sera, again in vivo, a dramatic decrease in NR1. These animals are now being run through a series of behavioral assays, again, to document whether or not in an animal model of this sort we can recapitulate the essential features of this human disorder. Now, people have commented that these autoimmune disorders of the nervous system are, in fact, quite rare. And I wanted to speak to that very briefly. Josep made his initial observation in late 2006 and published the first analysis of roughly 20 patients in late 2007. That attracted a lot of interest. He screened the serum and CSF of many patients that were referred to him from across the world. By the time we published our cellular analysis in late 2008, we had over 200 patients, and as of now, that number has almost doubled. So what's interesting is that it's a relatively common neurological disorder that has been dramatically underdiagnosed. Now, in the course of doing this screening, what's become apparent is that there are a cohort of patients with a very distinct clinical neurological syndrome that fall under this rubric of anti-NMDA receptor encephalopathy that I've been describing. But there are patients who, by immunoprecipitation and mass spec and the other approaches that I described, don't seem to have autoantibodies against the NR1 subunit of the NMDA receptors, but clearly have IgG in the CSF. And it turns out those patients have fallen into four other categories. One category I'm showing you here, there's a cohort of patients with very distinct clinical presentations. So, for example, no psychosis, but a relapsing, remitting, very dramatic short-term memory loss that appears to be like a purely amnestic disorder. Those patients have antibodies against the GluR1 or GluR2 subunit of the AMPA receptor. A second set of patients have autoantibodies against presynaptic GABA-B receptors. Another cohort against an accessory subunit to a voltage-gated potassium channel, and even a couple of patients that have autoantibodies against alpha-norexin 3. All synaptic proteins, all with distinct clinical manifestations, and that really the utility of these approaches and the utility of these human disorders is that because we can do both cellular and circuit and behavioral analysis in all of them, we have the opportunity of asking the unique roles that NMDA receptors containing NR1 subunits, AMPA receptors, GABA-B receptors, for example, play in synaptic function in general, but also how they contribute to the very distinct learning and memory, cognitive and psychosis-based disorders that the humans with these disorders show. And I'm showing you here just one slide from a set of experiments that are ongoing where we treated neurons with antibodies, patient antibodies against GluR1 or GluR2. And you can see, as for the anti-NMDA receptor disorder, there's a dramatic decrease in surface anti-GluR1 or GluR2, as the case may be, without a wholesale loss of pre- or postsynaptic markers. So again, a very specific molecular excision, in this case of AMPA receptors. And those patient antibodies also cause a dramatic decrease in total GluR2-3 protein, but not NR1. So again, very specific effects on surface and synaptic protein here. So the goal of this work, I think, if you put the two pieces of the story, that two stories that I told you today together, is to really develop using our basic science sort of repertoire and using the opportunities that are afforded to us by this interesting set of human neurological syndromes to really understand the rules by which synapses are made in the developing nervous system and are maintained. And second, what happens when those synapses are disrupted? What are the parameters under which we get synapse destruction and reformation? And what effects do those have on circuit function and behavior? Again, both in animals and in humans. And that's the long-term goal of this collaborative work that I told you about in the second half of my talk. I want to acknowledge the efforts of the people in my lab who did almost all of the work that I told you about today. Ethan Hughes did all of the work on astrocyte-mediated effects on inhibitory neurons. And he and Xiaoyu Peng, another talented graduate student in the lab, collaborated to do all of the work on the anti-NMDA receptor encephalopathy that I told you about. Xiaoyu is picking up on the anti-AMPA receptor encephalopathy as we speak. And the work on the astrocytes was started by anecdotal observations made by Serena Berger-Almeria, a former MD-PhD student in the lab. And I want to thank Marion Scott, Wenchen Song, and Amy Kugoth for their help in putting all of this work together. Our collaborators on the astrocyte project, Harry Ischiropoulos and his group, and our collaborators on these autoimmune encephalopathies, in particular, my lab neighbor and close colleague, Joseph Dalmau, his lab, Mason Lai and Lei Zhao, Dave Lynch, who's mapping out the epitope on NR1 and AMPA receptors that these patient autoantibodies recognize, and his graduate student, Amy Gleichman, who's done a lot of work on that epitope mapping, and finally, my close collaborator, Tom Parsons, who's helped us with the whole cell recording. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take questions.
And I'll ask you a couple of questions. So in the first part, when you talk about astrocytes, when you talk about excluding a role where thrombospondins are being inadvertently, that's the patient experiment before you add the conditioning medium to the neuron.
That's correct. That's correct.
Because it seems possible, even likely, that actually the mechanism is BDNF-dependent.
Can you repeat the question for the webcast, please?
Repeat the question? So the question was, how are the depletions, for example, of neurotrophins done in the astrocyte effects on inhibitory neuron experiments, and whether or not, despite the fact that the neurotrophins were depleted from ACM before neurons were treated, couldn't, for example, neurotrophins released from the neurons themselves be mediating these effects? And that's a legitimate question. Experiments I didn't present today, but that we've done with mix and match cultures of knockout astrocytes or knockout neurons, and kind of mixing and matching those pairs, I think pretty definitively rule out a role for BDNF and NT3 signaling in inhibitory synaptogenesis. It doesn't rule out a role for those neurotrophins in glutamatergic synapse construction, and I think there's quite a well-established role for that particular subtype of synapses. And we did not exhaustively investigate, for example, the contribution of NGF. So collectively, this kind of experiment, I think, pretty definitively rules out a major role for neurotrophins provided by neurons or astrocytes in this early phase of GABAergic synapse construction.
Paraneoplastic syndromes, quite spectacular results. So, what tumors are we talking about here? Is it always ovarian teratomas
we're talking about? The question was, what are the tumors that are associated with the anti-NMDA or, for example, anti-AMPA receptor paraneoplastic encephalopathy? And at first, in the first paper that was published by Dalmau and colleagues, most of the patients that had a tumor had an ovarian teratoma. There were a couple of men with testicular teratomas. The teratomas are tumors that are benign, stem cell type tumors where the cells will differentiate into many different tissues. If you Google ovarian teratoma, for example, you will pull up pictures where these tumors have hair and teeth and bone, nervous system, and so forth. So there are many cell types that are differentiated in these tumors, and often, not always, but often, the immune system mounts a response to these aberrantly presented antigens. However, not all patients have ovarian teratomas. Some of the patients had thymomas. Some had small cell lung carcinoma and a couple of other obscure tumors. And finally, there's about a third to half of patients now that we've had an expanded patient population that don't have identifiable tumor at all. And interestingly, an even smaller percentage, maybe I'm making up this number, but 5% or less, where the syndrome and the autoantibodies were identified. No tumor had been recognized, but when those patients were re-examined with MRI and CAT scan, for example, then a tumor was found. So the question is just whether or not the tumor is always the event that triggers this autoimmune response, or whether or not there is a panoply of events, mechanisms that can induce this autoimmune response, and why, for example, is it an autoimmune response that involves the NMDA receptor as opposed to something else? These are all questions that we don't have good answers for just yet.
So back to the first half of your story, do you have any insights into the generalizability? So in terms of either the neurons, because you use the campus, which you try other regions, and also the astrocytes, because I'm assuming you use cortical evidence.
Actually, we used. The question was: Do we have any insights into the cell type specificity of these effects? Is it an effect of hippocampal astrocytes on hippocampal neurons, or cortical astrocytes have the same effect, or what about cortical neurons and so forth? So we did do a series of mix and match experiments. We didn't do this exhaustively, but we did hippocampal neurons with cortical astrocytes, and hippocampal neurons with spinal cord astrocytes. And hippocampal astrocytes have the most potent effect on hippocampal GABAergic neurons, even though cortical astrocytes did this as well, but spinal cord astrocytes not so much. And what we haven't done, hippocampal astrocytes can promote the formation of inhibitory synapses if we make cortical cultures. But what we haven't done is ask if, the reverse, the opposite mix and match. So we have some idea that there is a regional specificity. We know from the work of Megan Edegaard and Ben Barris and even some of our proteomic analysis that not all astrocytes in terms of their secretome are the same. But we haven't done a really careful analysis the way you'd like to say, well, can we use that to advantage to try to reduce the number of candidates that we'll test in our bioassays? That was our first thought in doing the mix and match. But the complexity of the secretome is so great, we didn't think it would get us very far, so we stopped.
I imagine that lymphocytes making anti-NR1 antibodies are normally part of cognitive function.
Over coffee, we imagine it actually quite a bit. The question was whether or not lymphocytes expressing anti-NR1 subunits have some effect on cognitive function. And if you take the tongue out of the cheek of that question and you ask whether or not there's evidence that abrogation of NMDA receptor function has an impact on cognitive function, obviously the answer to that is yes. And then you can ask the interesting question of, in that proportion of individuals that have NMDA or hypofunction or a syndrome that's consistent with that, how many of them have autoantibodies against the NR1 receptor, a subunit of the NMDA receptor, for whatever reason? And there's discussion of a screening effort using, for example, a population of individuals with schizophrenia at the VA hospital in Philadelphia to ask that very kind of question. The second piece of the answer that I think is quite interesting is that recent work that was done by Giuseppe and his clinical colleagues has characterized a set of pediatric patients at Children's Hospital and a couple of other children's hospitals that present with a somewhat different set of clinical manifestations. It's not full-blown psychotic behavior, for example. It's very difficult to assay a pure sort of learning and memory type disorder. But the similarities between the presentation of these pediatric patients and the adult presentation was similar enough that these pediatric patients were assayed for anti-NMDA receptor antibodies. And the paper that is just in the press now reports a characterization of the first 20 or 25 patients ranging in age from 18 months to 5 years. So this is a disorder that spans age, very wide age range, and that cohort raises the possibility of what developmental effects might be manifest in juveniles that have autoantibodies around during the time that circuitry is being established and pruned in an activity-dependent way. So I think there are a number of fascinating directions this work can go, and we're really at the very tip of what we think is likely to be a very big iceberg.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.